Today's Teisho will be on case 3 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan. Gute raises a finger. Whenever Gute Osho was asked about Zen, he simply raised his finger. Once, a visitor asked Gute's boy attendant, "What does your master teach?" The boy too raised his finger. Hearing this, Gute cut off the boy's finger with a knife. The boy, screaming with pain, began to run away. Gute called to him, and when he turned around, Gute raised his finger. The boy suddenly became enlightened. When Gute was about to pass away, he said to his assembled monks, "I obtained one-fingered Zen from Tenryu and used it all my life, but still did not exhaust it." When he had finished saying this, he entered eternal nirvana. Mumon's comment, the enlightenment of Gute and of the boy does not depend on the finger. If you understand this, Tenryu, Gute, and the boy, and you yourself are all run through with one skewer. Mumon's verse, Gute made a fool of old Tenryu, emancipating the boy with a single slice, just as Kyore cleaved Mount Kasan to let the Yellow River run through. Yesterday, somebody was telling me about a difficult and unpleasant experience. A co-worker. You know, often in people's jobs, they have to evaluate other workers. So I myself have to evaluate people who are teachers in my program. And this is a regular part of the job. Somebody evaluates my performance too. So it's always very tense, of course, to have somebody evaluate your performance, because it's not a dialogue, right? I mean, somebody can write up a report on you and say your performance is good, your performance is bad, and usually built into the system, there's an opportunity for you to respond, you know, but it doesn't have necessarily the same weight as the original judgment. But in all lines of work, this goes on. You know, there's a kind of evaluation procedure. Yesterday, my wife had a toothache, and I went online to a site that evaluated dentists in the area. And we picked a dentist who had 5 out of 5, picked the best dentist. And so she can go to the dentist next week. So this evaluation process is something, you know, that's part of life. But it can be difficult. You know, my friend was telling me this story about she had to observe somebody's work, and this person was an older person, older worker, almost 60, and had been passed over for promotion many times, and was basically, that's difficult, right? I mean, that's something we can all face in life, you know. You can do a good job and get passed over for promotion, and that really hurts. It hurts, you know, when people don't see the good work we're doing, and we're not rewarded for our efforts. That can feel like a real injustice. It can really be troubling, and it can eat away at you, you know. It might even be worse, though, not to be good at what you do, you know, and yet to be sort of stuck in your job. my father-in-law was really like the, I often say to my father-in-law, you know, I think you're the luckiest man on earth. My father-in-law has always been so good at his jobs. It's just like, it's really remarkable how good my father-in-law was at his jobs, and he was just sort of like he didn't become rich, but he was very very successful in his work, you know. And he's been worked at Sandia Labs in Albuquerque for 50 years. So when he got out of World War II, he went to work at Los Alamos for a little while, but he's like a design engineer. And then he didn't like Los Alamos, and he went down to Sandia Labs and worked there for 50 years. And at the end of his life, they didn't want him to retire. They kept trying to get him to come back. You know, most people in their careers sort of fall behind the advancement of knowledge, you know. And so at some point, you know, when you get out of college, you're right at the cutting edge. And then often through your career, you're on a wave of change, and then the wave washes out to sea, and you're sort of floating on the water, you might or might not be able to catch the next big wave, you know. That happens to scientists, it happens to people in all kinds of fields and business, you know. One day you're just obsolete a little bit, you know. You can still contribute, but your knowledge isn't as up to date as it used to be. But my father-in-law somehow was able to deal with that, and you know, right to the end they were sort of begging him not to retire. And I just thought, that is, what a lucky guy, you know. He's always been good at what he does. In fact, he's almost like a charmed person, you know. When he was, his father owned a business in Oklahoma. During the Great Depression, he was a businessman who had a number of different businesses in Oklahoma. And Jack was part of a division of people in Oklahoma who were sent off to the war to fight in World War II. And his whole division was sent to the Philippines, where they were slaughtered and captured by the Japanese and put on this death march. And almost nobody lived. But they had taken my father, Jack, off of the division before it went to the Philippines because he was so good with fixing cars, which is one of his hobbies. And so he didn't go to the Philippines and get sent to the Bataan Death March. And then he was a very good cartographer because of his engineering training. So he worked at headquarters, and he said all these military leaders couldn't read maps, and he was a great cartographer and map reader and map drawer. And so he had these talents, and he just kept getting kept out of harm's way all through the war. And then he got out of the war and he got good jobs, and there's very few people ever have that kind of a life history, you know. This person, this 60-year-old guy who had to be evaluated, wasn't like that at all. He was 60 years old and not successful at what he had chosen to do in life. He had been passed over for many promotions. And that's a very difficult situation to be in, not to be good at what you have to do, you know? And you can do your best, but you might not be able to be as good as you want to be, you know? And you might not be able to be good at all, you know? You just might not be a good fit. People don't always get to choose the work they do in life. Sometimes you have to do the work you have to do. So anyway, my friend had to evaluate the performance of this 60-year-old man. And my friend is quite a bit younger than this guy. And this 60-year-old man was doing really a very poor job. And my friend had to write a report on this guy. And the report had to be negative. You know, it didn't have to be, it wasn't cruel, but you have to point out that things aren't going well. So my friend, who's younger than this, much younger than this 60-year-old person, wrote the report, and of course it was shown to this person. And the person became furious, right? Furious, hurt, angry, and confronted my friend and just melted down, right? Just absolutely deliriously angry. And so when my friend came to sit at the sit here, she was really you know, replaying these events in her head, you know. And this happens to all of us, right? You know, we all can have these experiences that are very difficult to deal with and that really get under our skin. They could involve us in many different ways, you know. You know, when we come in to do our zazen, you know, this is such an important, I mean, I think this is the most beautiful thing in the world. I really think Zen is quite unique, and that something like our Sangha is also quite unique, you know. A place where you can come and sit down and practice with others, clearing away your karmic obstacles. And those karmic obstacles are events like the one my friend described, you know. You go to work, and you're asked to write a report, and you write a report, and you have to be honest about it. And it just creates this chain reaction. And it produces anger and hostility, and it's like a koan in itself, right? Right, having to write a report like that is a kind of koan, right? Because you know, if you don't speak the truth, then that's no good. But if you speak the truth, there might maybe repercussions and so on. So my friend came in and sat down on the cushion, and of course, when you sit down on the cushion, all of these events can start replaying, right? All of these events can start replaying. And you can find yourself feeling those same emotions, those same powerful emotions again. And I'm sure everybody here has had that experience. You know, people mistakenly think that Zen is about sitting down on the cushion and being calm and collected and blissful and empty, and that's somewhat true, but it's also true that we have these experiences that we bring to the cushion, and it's a good thing we do bring them to the cushion, you know, because when we bring them to the cushion, we can work through them, and if we don't bring them to the cushion, you know, that can be a problem, you know, because they just stay there, you know. When I was in graduate school, I had a professor whose name was Don Bialystoski, who was a really intolerant person. If you didn't think just his way, he would kill you, you know. And I didn't know this about him, and I took a course with him, and I wrote a paper. And he tore the paper apart. He just tore it apart. And I actually thought, my God, I'm going to have to leave graduate school. This guy, you know, has just destroyed my my paper, and he's insinuated that I'm an idiot. And if I get an F in the course, I have to leave graduate school. I'll never finish my PhD. And you know, I remember every time I would go back to Padelford Hall, where the English department was housed, The whole building seemed frightening to me. You know, the whole building seemed ominous and threatening. And I actually just hated to go into the building itself, you know. And this is really karma, right? This is really karma, because it's like an event like that, we might be able to push it aside, but it's not really gone. And it has this quality of spilling over into everything else, you know? And all of this happens unconsciously. A lot of this happens unconsciously. So I had this terrible event with my professor where he didn't like the critical approach I was using, and just he could have just said, look, I don't like this critical approach, I want you to use another critical approach. But instead he tore the paper apart, and he actually accused me of dishonesty, of misrepresenting what I had read, and so on and so on. And he unloaded on me with great ferocity. Later, I realized that he was very frustrated with his own career. The kind of criticism, the kind of approach that he took was not catching on, and he was very disappointed about this. He was very angry and disappointed that people weren't listening to him and joining his school of criticism. And I was really, without knowing it, using the school of his enemies. And so I was kind of just like a graduate student trying to survive, you know. And when I turned in this paper, which was written in a certain way, using a certain style and so on, my teacher became furious at me. And really, when he was crushing me, he wasn't just crushing me, he was crushing all these other people who he imagined as standing in his way. This is all so human, isn't it? This is the world of karma, right? The world of karma. It's like we're carrying around these events in our lives, which, you know, we may or may not have even forgotten consciously. But they're triggering all these responses, you know. So this guy's a teacher. He's teaching a course on romantic poetry. You'd think nothing could be more innocent, you know, than romantic poetry. But he managed to turn a course in romantic poetry into a living hell for one poor graduate student, right? You know, and you know, basically, I had to do a lot of zazen to get over that, you know. Because, I mean, literally, he just insinuated I was a complete moron and a liar, you know. So there wasn't much left, you know, wasn't much opportunity to have any self-esteem left. And I did go home thinking, well, I wonder what I'll do now that I have to drop out of graduate school. And I remember going for a long jog and then coming home and doing a lot of zazen. But he himself was haunted by these past events and was acting like almost automatically, you know, almost automatically. And it, you know, this is something we grossly underestimate. We grossly underestimate this dynamic, you know. I mean, modern people, and especially modern Western people, put incredible faith in consciousness and rationality, thinking and basically sort of like self-determination. You know, these are like the cornerstones of our world. So we think of people basically as rational actors, as they say, you know. We make reasonable decisions on the basis of the evidence. You know, but humans are not rational actors. Even at their best moments, you know, they have this unconscious undercurrent is going on all the time. And this is why people could be like very, very rational on the surface, but they use their reason for all kinds of crazy things, you know. And this is one of the great mysteries of the modern world, you know. this society is based on rationality, you know. So we have all these scientists very carefully going through, you know, examining problems and coming up with solutions. But then, you know, the things they invent or the solutions that they develop are totally crazy. You know, they have implications that are totally destructive. I was driving over here listening to my favorite, Living on Earth, my favorite ecology radio program. And they were talking about, like, the fact that in one, they did some sample of water and there were like 8,000 chemicals in the water, and many of them were carcinogenic, you know. And right now there's just like whole armies of chemists developing new chemicals, you know. And it's and so, you know, their procedure is like rational, right? But what they're doing is crazy. You know, it's crazy. And you know, if you say, why are we inventing all these new chemicals? You know, didn't we get along well without having them? You know, weren't we all pretty happy? You know, wasn't everything okay? Yes. So why are we inventing them, right? You know, when some of them are going to blow up in our face. So it's like we're rational on one level, but underneath we're not rational, you know. So anyway, my friend, went to work hoping to teach the classes, and this guy was waiting for her and, you know, wanted to kill her, and exploded and melted down. And all of this is like karma in action, right? I mean, he's a 60-year-old person who has a heavy karmic load, right? Not successful. You know, that's hard to take. It's hard, you know. People can start out there, you know. I mean, I've known a lot of people who have started out with high hopes and didn't quite achieve what they wanted to achieve, you know. So, you know, my sister-in-law is a really great artist, you know, and basically she has a master's in clinical psychology, and she works in a halfway house for emotionally disturbed children. And she's worked there most of her life, and she paints, but her art has never really gotten the attention I would hope it would get, you know. So, you know, when she was a young art student, she must have thought, you know, maybe I'll be the next Georgia O'Keeffe, you know. But it didn't work out, you know. And I've known other people like that too, you know. They have a great passion for what they do, but in conventional terms, not necessarily successful. And they, I think they can live with that because they love what they do, you know. But sometimes people are, you know, they lose the love, they lost the love they used to have for what they do, and they're not very good at what they do, and that's very difficult. It's a heavy, that could happen to somebody, you know, and it's a heavy load to carry. You can, you know, sometimes people change jobs just to avoid that, you know, and that's a good move, maybe. So anyway, this is a 60-year-old guy. He's hanging on by a thread, and yet he's doing a truly terrible job, and you can't let him do the terrible job. You know, you can't let him go on doing a terrible job. So, it, you know, you have to criticize. You have to say, look, this guy's a terrible teacher. I mean, I do this kind of thing myself, you know. But, you know, because he's carrying around this heavy burden of karma, he can't change. You know, he can't free himself from his own karma. He can't say, well, I'm not very good at what I do. Maybe I should change jobs, or maybe I should try a new approach, you know. But he is too afraid, you know, too afraid. So everything becomes a threat, you know. Well, anyway, you know, his karma becomes the karma of my friend, and since I've heard the story, now it's my karma, you know. All of this is spreading all over, you know, and we're going through our lives acting in response to events that are unfolding below the level of consciousness. And some of these become like obsessive loops, you know. Even today, after many years of zazen, there are certain events that are very, I have to work very hard to get through them, because they remind me of things that happened in the past, you know. I have karma too, you know, so sometimes an event will resonate with my own past experience in ways that I have to do a lot of sitting to overcome. But this is really how humans are, and it's too bad that our culture doesn't really recognize how completely true this is, you know, that we have a very, very false image of human beings, you know. It's very naive, and it's very distorted. You know, you can't explain much about what's going on if you think that humans are rational actors who make decisions on the basis of the evidence. It's just not so. People are driven by all kinds of compulsions, and you see it everywhere, you know, and fears and so on. So something like Zen, I think, is really quite amazing and wonderful. And, you know, if you sit a lot in this room, you can sometimes walk into the room and go, oh boy, here we go again, more Zazen, you know. But, you know, actually this is such a precious thing. I don't know anywhere else in the world that you can find something like what you can find in Zazen. You know, when you come in and you sit down on the cushion, you're really like purifying body, mind, and heart. And it's a beautiful, beautiful process. And if you've done it for a while, you know, please don't take it for granted. You know, it's a little bit, it can get a little bit like this, you know. When I started doing Zazen, I was definitely not a happy person. I think I was suffering from depression, really. I didn't know it. And when I started doing Zazen, it was very, very beneficial for me in ways I couldn't explain. And then after a while, I really did begin to sort of reach a little plateau where, you know, sometimes my practice wouldn't be as marvelous as it used to be, you know. And I realized in retrospect that this was because the medicine was so effective, you know. I actually just became like a sane person. And that was a huge improvement over the unhappy and hysterical person I had been. But I didn't always appreciate how much better I was, you know. But anyway, you know, this is really quite a remarkable practice because, you know, you can sit down on the cushion and purify body, mind, and heart. And just sitting on the cushion is good for you, you know. There's a huge body of research that says that simply relaxing is extremely beneficial for your health. It actually lowers cholesterol in your veins, you know, in your blood vessels. Apparently, cholesterol buildup is triggered to some degree just by stress alone. You know. So just coming in here and sitting on the cushion and calming down is itself profoundly like life enhancing. Also, you know, I was just reading something about posture and so on. You know, the posture we sit in is actually good for your back, stretching your muscles, even though, you know, after an hour and a half of sitting, your muscles might be shrieking. All you're doing is stretching your muscles. You know, that stretching exercise is actually very good. It keeps you limber. You know, your spine will be flexible, and that's very important. So, you know, when you sit down on the cushion, your pulse rate is lowering and it becomes regular. And so just in terms of sheer physical health, this is quite good for you, you know. And then, you know, you sit down on the cushion and you start watching your breath, and the problems of the day can arise, and you can deal with them, you know. And this too is like a great gift, you know, there's most people don't work these events through, and they accumulate, and they begin to create shadows in your experience. It's like your visibility is impaired. You know, after that event with my professor, when he tore me to pieces, when I would go toward Padelford Hall, I would feel great anxiety. The building itself made me anxious and fearful. But it wasn't really the building, right? It was the little guy inside who had yelled at me, you know. But it began to like bleed over or spill over into other aspects of my life. And you know, Zen is this wonderful opportunity to work through those kinds of events so that they don't have that kind of an effect. You know, every once in a while, you'll come in and you'll sit down on the cushion, and it might be difficult when you're sitting. You know, you might have pain, you might have discomfort, you might be racked with anxiety thinking about something that happened to you. Or you could be, you know, reliving anger or something, and you just keep coming back to Mu. And every once in a while, I'm sure you've had this experience, you know, when I got off the cushion today and we went for our Kinhin, I felt so purified, I felt so liberated. You know, it's such a beautiful experience to be cleaned by Zen. And you get off the cushion. It doesn't happen every time, but sometimes, especially if you're working through something that's very difficult, you know, you might find you get off the cushion and you feel so good. You just feel so good. It's like being young again. You know, I mean, if you're young, that doesn't sound very great. But if you're looking at 60, it sounds great. You know, it's like being young again. You know, I feel full of energy and welcoming the next moment. You know, welcoming the next moment. And even though you might be in a turmoil on the cushion when you get up, you can feel this purity, you know, that's so wonderful. And it's because you've like cleared away the shadows that accumulate, you know, as you go through the week, as you go through the years. After a while, it's almost like our vision of the world is so shadowed, we can't see clearly because all these memories are still haunting us like ghosts, you know, in our mental closet. And they begin to limit what we can see and what we think and how we feel. And it's so wonderful to open up and be clear and clean. It's like being like an open door for life. It's very difficult, but when it happens, it's so wonderful, right? When you can just say, you know, let me at the next minute. I just want to embrace the next minute. That's very rare and very beautiful. When you're sitting on the cushion, you have to, of course, be in the appropriate state of mind. If you're fearful and anxious, and you review the events of the past in that mindset, you won't be better. You won't get better. You'll get worse. You know. When we're in what we call the small self, reviewing the things that make us anxious only triggers more anxiety. Then you're caught in a loop. See, that's the classic loop, right? You know, so you remember the guy yelling at you, and then you basically feel angry or fearful, and so on and so on. And you just keep replay. You can keep. This is how most people try to deal with their problems. You know, they try to be rational actors, and they try to watch the mind in a dispassionate way, but it's very difficult. You know, and generally, their normal consciousness is too closely allied to their small self, you know. And so they can't do it. They can't get perspective. And this is why people go for therapy. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with therapy. You know, The therapist gives you an outside perspective because you just can't get it in your small mind, you know. But you know, we Zen people learn how to enter mushin, that blank mind. And that mind is not fearful, it's not angry, it's empty. It has no content, you know. And when you look at events from that standpoint, eventually they stop triggering conditioned responses, right? So it's like if you do enough zazen, you go back to Padelford Hall and you think, oh, what a beautiful building, right? Instead of constantly associating it with bad events that happened to you in your life, you know. So being able to find mushin and stay in mushin is quite crucial. You know, it's easy to, you know, some people think they're meditating, especially people who haven't had like formal training, but they do this on their own. You know, they might sit quietly somewhere and thinking through your problems is not the Zen way. You know, thinking, like analyzing or turning over in your mind or trying to see the event from a new angle, this is all discriminating intellect. And generally speaking, this is not successful. This is why people go to therapists, because that doesn't usually work. And Zazen understands that too. You know, so our method is to enter mushin. And usually when people are in mushin, they feel pretty good. You know, a lot of people actually feel blissful. You know, the first time you really enter blank mind, you can feel very good. It can be very blissful, very beautiful. There's no future. There's no past. There's no yes or no. There's no right or wrong. And when you move from that blankness into the moment, it's very beautiful. Sometimes the moment can just seem like heaven. See, so when you look at events through that mind, which has no characteristics, it's not invested, it's not, you know, it's not afraid, it has nothing to gain and nothing to lose. You know, that's a very special kind of perception, very special. You know, another person in our group was telling me about an experience. I don't think this person will mind my talking about it. The person had been overseas, had gone to this other country, and had a wonderful time. It's sort of like being on vacation, right? You know, this person had been in this other country and basically had just a thrilling time, and basically said, you know, I was so carefree there. You know, I didn't care what people thought of me, nobody knew me, you know, and I was just happy all the time, you know. Even if people told me, you know, yelled at me in some other language, you know, it was okay, you know. And I myself have experienced that, you know. When I was got out of college, I went to Albuquerque, New Mexico, because I wanted to backpack with my friend Larry Sullivan. And we both got these terribly crummy jobs, you know. He got a job grinding. My friend Larry Sullivan, who has orange hair, you know, he's got really red, he's obviously of Irish background, and his hair is just like almost screaming red, you know. And he was an illegal employee in an Indian jewelry store. You know, they sold jewelry that was supposed to be made by Navajo Indians. And my friend Larry Sullivan was tucked away in the back, you know, grinding the jewelry. That's strictly illegal. You know, there are actually the laws in New Mexico that say this is Indian jewelry has to be made by real Indians, you know. But my friend Larry got this illegal job, which he hated, you know. Grinding jewelry, and I got a job. I was lucky. I got a job in a restaurant and started cooking. And you know, the job, when I got the job, I paid like $2.75 an hour, you know, which even then was nothing. You know, that was nothing. You know, I made $80 a week before taxes. You know, now you know where I lived was really a dump. So it was actually, I can't remember, it was like $100 a month or something for the apartment. You know, and so I lived in a dump. You know, basically, it was right next to a lumber yard, and I was making $80 a week. You know, and you know, I worked 6 days a week, you know, basically. And I had to get to work. I had no car, so I had to walk to work. And I walked like miles to work and miles back, you know. And when I got to work, I would we had to get everything ready for the lunch shift, you know. So you had to get the cut the eggplants and fry the eggplants and stuff the manicotti. And do you know do all the food prep and get it all ready and then people would come in for lunch and then after the lunch shift was over, I think it ended around 3 or something. So you got there around 9, maybe around 9, and there was a lot of prep for the day, and then you had to do the lunch and then clean up and then maybe around 3 you were supposed to go home for a little while because they didn't want to pay you to hang out there. You were supposed to go home, and I couldn't go home. It was too far to walk. So I was near the University of New Mexico. I used to go over and sit in the library and read books. Or when summer came, I would just go to the park and lie down on a bench and go to sleep, you know. And then around 5, you'd come back to the restaurant and work until like midnight. That was my day, 6 days a week. And you know, my friend Larry, he too was making his miserable wage, and he was grinding this jewelry and polishing jewelry all day. But you know, we didn't have any expectations. You know what I mean? I didn't think I was going to be doing this for the rest of my life, so it wasn't a problem. And being in New Mexico was great. You know, actually, you know, I didn't care what people thought of me. You know, I didn't care if somebody at work yelled at me. It was like, fine, this is just temporary, you know, it's not a big deal, you know. I was just like a visitor, you know. I was just passing through, you know. And the strange thing was, it was great. It was so great. And this member of our Sangha who had gone overseas had the same experience, you know. Everything was just like an adventure, you know. And you know, if you practice Zen long enough, it doesn't always work. But the more you do it, the more it works. You know, really. You know, life can be like that, right? We get so attached to things, and we all do. We get so attached to things, you know, and it's very difficult to have that mind which doesn't hold on tight. It's just enjoying the show, you know. It's just going with the flow, you know. When I was in Albuquerque, I was so happy, and basically I had a life that many people would find almost like oppressive, you know. It was just get up, go to work, work all day, go to sleep, and I was so happy. I had everything I really wanted, almost, you know. I was very happy because I had zero expectations, you know. And I think my friend was like that too overseas, you know. Zero expectations, everything's interesting. Well, you know, when you're in deep mushin and you look at events in your life, it takes a lot of work, but you can get to the place, and it might take months, you know. But you can get to the place where you say, you know, it's not a problem. It's not a problem, you know. It's like, this is just the unfold. This is like watching a movie. You know, I'm just like going to the movies. Years ago, I was reading an interview with a Chinese writer. And the Chinese writer said, you know, growing up with the in the Red Guard period was so terrible, I just decided to drop out of the human race. And he said, but then later, you know, I got married and I had a child and I published my first book and I realized I had to rejoin the human race. And I thought to myself, don't do it! Don't do it! Notice I'm not saying you don't. I'm not saying don't. He shouldn't have gotten married. I'm just saying don't join the human race. You know, there's a certain way of going through life where you're agonizing over every moment of it. See, if that's what he means by joining the human race, I think don't do it. You know, there's a certain wisdom in helping, doing your best, but not taking it too seriously, you know? I remember reading something else long ago, you know, about that same period in Chinese history. There was a man in China who was a very famous Taoist master. And during the Red Guard period, people were going into temples, Taoist temples and Zen temples, Chinese Buddhist temples, and tearing them to pieces and beating up all the monks and nuns and so on and so on. And this guy just, one day he just grabbed his stick, and he was probably older than I am, he just grabbed his stick and put on his shoes and a hat and he went out on the road. And he just stayed on the road until the whole thing blew over. Now you could say, no, that's so irresponsible, but I think having that mindset, you know, that unattached mindset is so important. Doesn't mean you don't help. Doesn't mean you don't help, but you're not worried. It's like, and I think I was talking about this last time. You know, imagine this. You know, most people are so afraid. And if you say, what are you afraid of? They might say, I'm afraid of death. You know, a lot of philosophers say people are really afraid of death. But I don't think people are afraid of death. I think they're afraid of life. And they're really afraid of, like, being humiliated or being a loser or not fulfilling their the dream of, you know, that they associate with themselves, you know. And that's all humans. You know, the worst thing that can happen to us is not fulfilling the existence we wanted, you know. Imagine if you could die. You know, imagine if you could, you know. You'd just go home and you'd die. And you'd be dead. And it would be over, you know. But then you could do all the things you do now, right? You know, you could, after dying, you could go have a nice lunch, you know. But, you know, if the guy wrote the check wrong and overcharged you, it wouldn't matter because you were dead, right? You say, oh, so what? I'm dead. Can't hurt me anymore, right? Somebody rear-ends you, you know, who cares? I'm dead, you know? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, see? I mean, being dead in that way would be really great, you know? You wouldn't be afraid anymore, right? Skydiving? No problem. You know, I'm already dead. What can go wrong? So wouldn't that be great? But it would, right? There's something that we keep holding on. We keep holding on. It's so tight, you know? If it were just all over, if we realized it's never going to, you know, I'm dead. It never worked out. I finally got killed, you know? Now I can enjoy my life. Everything would be beautiful. Imagine walking through life with no fear because you couldn't be hurt, right? You just couldn't because there was nothing left to hurt. Well, this is a version, you know, you could understand, this is what enlightened mind really is like, you know? And even the Dalai Lama has to work at this, you know. So it's, you know, even the Dalai Lama has to do his zazen and work through his obstacles. But sometimes we enter this state where it's all just happening automatically. It's just the unfolding of the Tao, of the natural way. And we're not trying to stop it. We're not trying to negotiate with the universe because we're already dead. This is a Mushin mind, you know. And so now it's just happening. and we can be with it and enjoy it and explore it, and it can't hurt us, you know. And these moments are the most precious moments in life. They're the most beautiful moments. It happens to everybody, though rarely. You know, sometimes people have to have a lot of drinks. You know, they drink too much. But, you know, all of a sudden they think, well, you know, maybe I will try skateboarding, you know. And maybe they break their necks, you know, but maybe they don't. But for a little while, it's a joyous experience not to worry, right? Just to be with it. It's like if you were already dead, you'd just say, well, it doesn't matter. I'm already dead. So in a way, you know, Zen is about being already dead. You know, we talk about dying on the cushion, and that's really what it's all about. You know, it's about, you know, I might have mentioned this before, but, you know, in Tibetan Buddhist temples and also in Japanese temples, and I suppose in Chinese temples too, you'll see these pictures of skeletons, you know, at play, you know. This is also part of Mexican culture, you know. They have a day called the Day of the Dead, and they have these statues of Mexican, Mexicans make these statues, often of paper mache, of skeletons like playing cards, skeletons driving cars, playing, you know, marimbas and guitars. And the skeletons are having such a great time, and they're like invulnerable, right? Invulnerable. And I think that message is very deep. You know, it's like, if you die, then everything that happens after that is just beautiful. It's just an amazing adventure. There's something about us that clings too tight, right? Too tight. And it's hard to let go, but being in Mushin means looking at everything through the eyes of the dead. You know, and there's a part of us that does not want to be dead, you know. There's a part of us that wants, you know, basically to be, you open the newspaper and the front page is Kurt, a story about Kurt. You go to the library and there's a big library full of books about Kurt, right? And there's statues of Kurt all over, right? All over town. And this has been renamed New Kurt, the state of the whole town, right? Yeah. Ah, how wonderful, you know, I've finally arrived, I'm finally there. You know, People magazine, the latest on Kurt, you know. See, there's a part of us that wants that. That's like to be really alive. You know, how alive am I? I'm everywhere, you know. Everybody thinks about me all the time, you know, they want to hear about my latest adventures, you know. There's a part of us that wants it and thinks that'll be happy. But, you know, then you get that might not be as satisfying as you think, because then you worry, you know. I mean, you see this with, you know, even Mr. Obama, right? You know, for a while it was the United States of Obama, right? The guy could do no wrong, and he may not even get reelected now. It's like, you know, being a self, you know, you when you want others to notice you, you know, they're going to notice your flaws, you know, they're going to start picking you apart because you're not, you know, nobody's quite what everybody wants, you know. Nobody can quite measure up, right? You know, so even though we think we want, you know, that world where there'll be a book on me every week and I'll be in the newspaper and my picture will be in people, just like the people who are in there now, you know, those guys all tried so hard to achieve that kind of self-presence. You know, maybe that's not the happiest life. You know, a lot of those people are really unhappy. You know, that might sound like sour grapes, you know. But I remember the other day reading Owen Wilson, the actor Owen Wilson, just tried to commit suicide. You think, what? You know, this guy, he's been in X number of, he must have millions of dollars. He's one of the most bankable stars in Hollywood. You know, Mel Gibson is a roaring alcoholic. You think, what? He's almost worth $1 billion, right? You know, his pictures in People magazine, you know. I mean, he's destroyed his reputation, you know, because of his bad behavior and his horrible views on things. But he did it himself, you know. So maybe being a self is not such a great thing, you know? Maybe it's overrated. Now, I'm not saying, you know, you want to run away from your problems. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that, you know, if you can find that empty place inside yourself, if you can die in a certain way, you can live without fear. You know, that's what Zen is all about, is learning how to die so you can live without fear, and then life becomes really quite extraordinary. And that's just a beautiful way to live. When you're in that state, everything has like one taste. It's like everything is one taste. It's really just it's just this luminous mind it's always a sunrise, or it's always a full moon, you know, illuminating everything around you. And so everything is just this beautiful presence over and over again, you know. It's quite beautiful, one taste. So, you know, sometimes Gute had to give teisho, you know, but sometimes his teishos really stunk, you know, and sometimes they were great. You're not supposed to have notes. Sometimes you give a teisho and halfway through you think, oh my God, where is this going, right? Genki Roshi used to give teishos sometimes. I would think, what the hell is he talking about, you know? And some were great, you know. Whether they were great or whether they were lousy, if Gute was dead on the cushion, it was a beautiful experience, you know? When you are in that mushin mind, when you've died on the cushion, you know, it's all the same over and over again, this beautiful adventure. It's like one finger always, yeah? So Gute's mind was this, he had great, you know, Gute had been practicing for a long time. And his mind had this great equanimity, the great calm of the already dead. Even people who have Dai Kensho can still have like this residual desire to be, David Bowie or, one of the Jonas Brothers, you know, something like that. You know, you still cling a little bit. You still want to be something. You still want to be somebody. You still want to be part of the human race, you know. But when your obituary has been written, you know, you're not part of the human race anymore. You've been excused from duty. Right? And then you're just a free agent, and it's beautiful. Dai Kensho is like the first experience of really like first big experience of being dead, you know, and it's great. And then, you know, we have karma, so we still think, oh, well, maybe I can still be alive, right? And, you know, you keep practicing with that for a long time, and eventually you really enjoy being dead, you know, because everything is so alive. So life is not what we think, and death is not what we think. Whenever Gute Osho was asked about Zen, he simply raised his finger. Once a visitor asked Gute's boy attendant, "What does your master teach?" The boy too raised his finger. Hearing of this, Gute cut off the boy's finger with a knife. The boy, screaming with pain, began to run away. Gute called to him, and when he turned around, Gute raised his finger. The boy suddenly became enlightened. When Gute was about to pass away, he said to his assembled monks, "I obtained one finger Zen from Tenryu and used it all my life, but still did not exhaust it." When he finished saying this, he entered into eternal nirvana, which he had been to before, of course. Okay. Mumon's comment, well, let me read the poem. Gute made a fool of old Tenryu, emancipating the boy with a single slice, just as Kyore cleaved Mount Kasan to let the yellow river run through.